Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
You know, I'm mad at you that we're recording this tonight, but without that part of the whole conversation. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitted across the internet, this is episode 278 of Registry Matters. Good evening. How are you, fine sir? I thought we were having the day off. So I don't care how you're doing. How about that?
Well, we were having the day off, but I texted you and you said you felt like recording.
I said I didn't mind if we recorded. That's how that actually went down. You said, hey, do you mind? I was like, all right. Go over to YouTube and press like and subscribe and notification bells. And if you aren't so inclined to become a patron, please go over to Apple Podcasts, whatever they call it now. Is it iTunes? I don't even know what they call it now. And don't leave a 4, a 3, a 2, or a 1 star review. Make sure it's a 5 star review and tell everyone how wonderful we are. And then go over to Reddit and tell all those people that don't like that we use the term PFR and tell them that PFR is used on purpose for a reason. And then subscribe with your favorite pod scripts. Hello. First, please renew my subscription to the podcast service for 4 more months. I've enclosed 40 stamps. Can we get some soups with that, Larry? I need a honey bun and some soups. And this should cover our standard fee, those 40 stamps. Second, and perhaps more important, in your recent podcast, you said that you were considering discontinuing the transcript service because of its cost and pain in the tookusness. He said buttness, but I decided to call it tookus. As a registrant and currently incarcerated federal prisoner, I respectfully ask and even humbly grovel that you do not do that. These transcripts are really the best and only resource that we have here on the inside. Not only is your information practical and useful, it is not available to us in any other form. As PFRs in federal prison, we have no access to the internet or even email. It would be cruelly ironic if our one source of legal news is discontinued. I will also add that your podcast is inspirational. It has inspired me to continue to advocate on behalf of PFRs, and it has notably improved my advocacy efforts. So what do we do? Were I on the outside, I would offer to take over the transcript service, and maybe someday when I'm out, you will hold me to that. In the meantime, I wonder if you might put out a call for volunteers who are currently available to help. As for me, all I can offer is encouragement and cold hard cash. Not just mine, but those of others who I've talked to who share my opinion of the service and have expressed a willingness to send money to help this going. How much does it cost per month to provide the transcript service? I'm confident that I can secure pledges from family, friends, and fellow inmates to keep this thing going. Please, just let us know. Thanks for your time and continued efforts. Sincerely.
Well, that was so touching when I read that, because despite our low circulation, I can see that it's really well received and appreciated, and that's very touching. And so to answer his questions, what I'm going to do for Mark is I'm going to send him a raw version of just the automated, just the automation of one he's recently read. And I'd like to get feedback about whether the raw version would be satisfactory. In my mind, it is not. I cannot in good conscience charge people money for something that's referred to as a transcript unless it fairly accurately represents what we've said, with corrections that I put in from time to time where we stutter and we misspeak and I put back what we were trying to say. But it's largely what we have said. And the cost of it, the $6 a month, if you want to do the math for it, the postage itself, because of the weight, is 90 cents. The envelopes are about 30 cents each that they go in. And the print and the paper, if you assign that some cost, you've basically consumed the entire revenue from the subscription with just the hard cost. But that doesn't count the labor cost of getting the transcript ready so that we can put it in these envelopes and send it to you. That requires about 3 hours worth of time, of my time and another hour's worth of Andy's time, to try to get the automated version into a format that I can work with. And if I could find a volunteer who would actually listen to the podcast on playback and make those corrections, that would be amazing. So far, I have not been able to find a paid staffer that will actually listen to it when they're receiving compensation. And with the clamor for the minimum wage to be at least $15 an hour, I don't see how I can offer anybody less than $15 an hour to do it. So you're talking about $45, $50 a week minimum. So the cost for the transcriptionist is going to be $50, $60 a week. So you're talking $200, $250 a month, which is what we would need to continue it, because I really don't have the energy to give up every day of my week to work. This has been a 7-day work week for me for some time now, since we haven't had a transcriptionist. And I hope those who've been receiving transcripts for a long time recognize that they have markedly improved in their accuracy versus what they were when I took it over myself, because I looked at them and I realized what you were getting was not what we were saying.
You and your ridiculous demands of it being accurate.
So if he can raise that kind of money, and it doesn't have to be him personally, but if that type of financial pledge were to be made and we find someone who will do it accurately, you can't just spell check. The words may be spelled correctly, but they may not be the words we spoke. So you have to actually listen to it.
There aren't really misspellings in it to begin with, unless we cover, like, there's going to be somebody's name in here that's funky. It's not John Smith. It's a funky name, and there's no way that Otter is going to pull that one off. Not going to happen.
Yes, but it converts a lot of words we say to words we didn't say.
True. But they're not misspelled. That's the thing.
Yeah, but as I'm saying, a spell check is not going to reveal those misspoken words where Otter has not gotten the correct words. You can spell check all you want to. They look beautiful, but it's just not what we said.
Yep. And then when we say case number out of the Federal Circuit, third edition, whatever, man, it trashes that. If I say 913, it's going to put a 9. They might even spell out 9 and then put 13. And so that's anytime there's a case number, anything like that, that has to all be transposed, however you want to look at that. So yeah, there's approximately, so I do like 2-ish hours editing to bring the production up, including the video. Maybe that's even like pushing into 3 hours. And then when there's another 3-ish or so hours to do the transcript, that's every week. That doesn't even include any prep.
That is correct. An average prep for that, which is not related to the transcript per se, but an average prep is about 4 or 5 hours Sunday, Saturday afternoon, getting these things set up so we can cover the salient points. It does no good to talk about a case if we don't know anything about it and haven't pulled out the relevancy of the case, because they can be 20, 30, 40, 50 pages. And if we just sat and read 50 pages, you'd get very bored very quickly. So we go back and forth with what I think are the most interesting points in the case as far as the law is concerned.
Why can't we just go into court, Larry, and wing it?
You can't.
Did you see the movie My Cousin Vinny?
I did not.
Oh, it's a story about these two kids who are falsely accused of a murder, and the attorney, the public defender, goes in there, and he hadn't read anything about the case. And then when the judge calls him to start doing his opening remarks and whatnot, he immediately develops this terrible stutter. And I'm not picking on people with stutters. The guy in the movie is. And they're just like completely flabbergasted that their attorney isn't prepared, can't articulate their case. But he was just going to wing it.
Well, now, can you admit that that's funny?
That's a really funny movie. This could actually be a Patreon extra where we watch My Cousin Vinny and you do the legal analysis of the work of My Cousin Vinny, who ends up to be their attorney, who's really just an ambulance chaser.
No way.
It's freaking hysterical. He has a law degree and everything, but all he does is knows how to file a brief to help you with your damages. Hey, you were in a car wreck recently. One of those people.
Yeah, don't remind me of that disappointing experience.
Okay, so we need about 1,000 people to... No, I'm just kidding. What kind of number... Do you even want to tell how many we have approximately of subscribers?
It has drifted from in the 50 to 60 range to about half that number. So we're sending out about 30 a week.
And if we had X, What would you be okay with if we had X number of people? Would 60 be enough to keep us doing it?
It would be a significant improvement because we would still have the 90 cents plus the 30 cents plus the printing cost.
Yeah.
But hopefully we would be able to look at the total revenue picture differently. Right now I'm looking at something that's bringing in very little money compared to all the effort that goes into it. Certainly. And it's not all about the money. But the money is a part of capitalist system. You do have to have money to make things work.
God, I thought you were not a capitalist, Larry.
Well, that's why the idea about donations is so exciting. If we can find a sponsor, this would be some. If somebody wants to sponsor, then that would be wonderful. If someone wants to volunteer, get a hold of us. We will set you up and see if you can do it.
If you want a part-time job, we'll set you up with it.
Yeah. That's been disappointing so far.
I understand. All right, well, then we shall move along. You put this article in here. It's Washington panel might push to outlaw PFR community notification. And this says that the policy board, the Washington State PFR policy board, was created by the legislature at the request of the governor, Inslee, in 2008. And coming in 2024, it is possible they might make some of their most controversial recommendations yet. If the idea and a draft proposal are sent to the legislature in 2024 and passed, notifications like this one pictured from the Grant County would go away.
Yeah, this is really good news. The policy board is considering doing away with public PFR notifications. The board held its latest meeting and is considering some eye-opening policies. Justice and Safety and Justice and Reentry Committee Chair Roger Goodman is behind these ideas. According to the information shared by the Center Square and Seattle-based talk show host Ari Hoffman, there are some officials who wish to do away with community notifications about PFRs when they move into neighborhoods.
According to a tentative draft proposal, which not all the members of the policy board have been made aware of, public notifications undermine public safety. The result, convincingly documented, is that these laws actually undermine public safety, the exact opposite of what lawmakers and the public so confidently assume they accomplish. Isn't this a positive step, though?
Yes, it is. The argument is that public safety is undermined when law enforcement issues bulletins about PFRs who, upon having completed their sentences and jail time, move into neighborhoods. Some of these offenders are considered low level, and some are like level three, which are considered more likely to offend. But the report suggests that offender registries should also not be made public, but only available to law enforcement. The draft report also makes other controversial suggestions concerning PFRs in Washington state.
To reiterate what you just said, they were also going to not let the registry stuff be public, like the website stuff that would only be available for law enforcement?
That's what it says is in the draft. I didn't read the draft, but we do have a link, or I think you're going to have a link to it in the
yep.
In the show notes.
And I mean, I should cue the laugh track. Do you think this will become law?
I really don't. The law enforcement and victim advocacy organizations will put forth an intense campaign of opposition, and they will do this with intent on scaring the public.
So even when you've put out information from the PhDs, the social scientists, et cetera, they'll still clamor for it because it makes them feel good?
I wish I could speak for why they do what they do. I think it's deeper than that. I think the victims' advocacies need to justify their existence, and scaring people is one thing that justifies existence. I think law enforcement has a similar motivation of scaring people, and this is a universal success. We're talking about registrants and the horrible danger of not keeping a tight noose around them. I just think that they can't help themselves. It's built into our system.
To read the report yourself, click on the link we have, and that'll be in the show notes. The website is KFLD News Talk, 870 AM, if you want to try and track that down before you get a link to it. So, sounded like it was going to be good news, Larry, but then you sank the battleship there at the end.
I just can't help myself, can I?
Apparently not. All right, man. So this is going to be the section where I have to press the beep, beep, beep button all the time, because there's going to be a lot of very disturbing language that comes down the pike here in the next few minutes. This comes from Macomb or Macomb Daily. It's probably Macomb, M-A-C-O-M-B Daily. And you did add this last week, so I had a whole week to read on this. And it's the people of the state of Michigan versus Kenneth Malone. And so we didn't have enough time to prepare for it, but we're going to try and cover it on this episode. Are you ready?
I think I'm mostly ready.
Okay, here we go. All right, so beep, beep, beep. Just kidding. All right, so I'm going to set it up. Defendant Malone appealed the trial court's order denying his motion for removal from the PFR Registration Act, called SORA. The trial court rejected Malone's argument that lifetime registration under SORA constituted cruel and unusual punishment under the state constitution. What was their decision?
The Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court.
All right, so if they did that and we're done and we can just call it quits and move on to the next segment?
We probably want to go a little bit more. You do have some questions after reading this for a whole week, right?
Yes, I do. I came up with some. I actually ran this through ChatGPT, and you know what it told me, Larry? The content goes against their policy, and it can't talk to me about it. That's what it said.
Now, that's funny.
All right, and yes, I have read it repeatedly over the week, and I cannot see how you can find any rational reason for what they did.
Really? No rational reason at all?
None.
I'd say that this is one of the most ridiculous cases I've ever seen in my 180-year lifespan, and that their decision is actually very rational.
They filed a petition for removal under Michigan's law. And what do you think the vehicle that they used to seek relief?
I don't think that they used the right vehicle. I always disapprove of filing a removal petition when you're categorically not eligible to be removed under that process. If you have a criteria, like, for example, in Georgia, if there's a group of offenders that are not eligible under the criteria, you would not file a petition for that because on the face of it, of the law, you're not eligible for relief. And on the face of Michigan law, he's designated as a Tier 3. That category is not eligible for removal from the registry. So I'm surprised he made it this far, because jurisdictionally, the court had no authority to release him from the registry.
And just to flip that over, if he were, hypothetically, or someone else is a level one, there is a vehicle. They may not be removed, but they could do this process to get relief and remove from the registry?
That would be my understanding. But okay. In this case, he filed the wrong vehicle. He should have used a petition for declaratory judgment.
All right. So you say he should do that. And what could you remind this fine audience what declaratory judgment is? I do recall a couple of years ago, Larry, where there was pretty much like a weekly thing we would talk about declaratory judgment. Can you remind us what it is?
Sure, we can do that. It's really just a vehicle. When you go to court, you file a cause of action. And through decades and millennia of judicial operations, these various vehicles have cropped up for seeking the type of relief you're looking for. And there's this nuanced petition that goes outside a petition for dissolution of marriage, or the standard ones you hear so frequently. It's called petition for declaratory judgment. And you're asking a judicial officer to take a look at the law and declare what your rights and obligations are under the law. And you're asking them for relief most of the time. When you ask for a declaratory judgment, you're wanting the court to side with you and say, declare in a form of a judgment that that law should not be applied to you. So he should have filed, in my opinion, a petition for declaratory judgment and stated his reasons why he felt like the Michigan PFR registry was unconstitutional as applied to him, rather than filing him a removal petition, which he was clearly not eligible to participate in that removal process.
Malone had cognitive issues, and I think that he probably deserves a break, Larry. Can't you cut this guy some slack?
I can, and he received many breaks over the course of his life as a result of his cognitive issues.
I see. So you're just going to be cold-hearted, Larry. Anyway, Malone was born on April 4th of 1998. He is characterized as cognitively and emotionally impaired, and received special education services throughout his school years. Malone's mother proffered that he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Additionally, Malone reported that he has a history of auditory hallucinations. Specifically, he claimed that auditory hallucinations commanded him to either commit suicide or commit acts of criminal sexual conduct. Where is your heart, Larry?
My heart is really not important here because we're a nation of laws, not a nation of hearts. And here's where he went off the rails. Malone took the victim into a bedroom for a nap. When Malone did not return, his mother went to the bedroom to check on them. Malone was lying on the bed with the victim with a blanket covering them. When his mother asked what he was doing, he admitted that he was indulging in self-gratification, except that's not how he described it. She removed the blanket and found that he had his pants and underwear pulled down. Additionally, the victim's pajamas and diaper were pulled down, and his organ was touching the victim's buttocks. She then called the police.
I'm glad you're covering the graphic stuff. For real. I don't even like that you're reading it. I'm going to have to see it again and listen to it 45 times over on the transcript.
Yep. Well, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Initially, Malone explained to the police that he exposed his organ.
Junk.
And placed it inside the victim's body. However, Malone later denied penetrating the victim's body and claimed to have only placed it between the victim's buttocks. Also, during the police interview, Malone acknowledged that he had penetrated his cousin, but the incident was not reported. This is all messed up. Can you at least admit that?
It's severely messed up. Although Malone proffered those auditory hallucinations and his prescribed medications caused his behavior, a mental health evaluation performed in March of 2015 diagnosed the defendant with generalized anxiety disorder and recurrent major depression, but not psychotic symptoms. Malone attributed his conduct to auditory hallucinations, but then admitted that his conduct was the result of his sexual impulses. That same report characterized Malone as oppositional and defiant, and noted he was physically or verbally aggressive towards adults or peers, regardless of whether provoked or not.
Yes, and at sentencing, Malone's counsel stated that a psychologist named Dr. Ryan determined that the defendant was bipolar and schizophrenic and suffered from attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and depression. Dr. Ryan estimated that the defendant was mentally in the range of 7 to 9 years old. It is noteworthy that the court pointed out that Dr. Ryan's report was not preserved in the lower court record, thus it wasn't really a part of the formal review. A psychological evaluation and reoffending assessment determined that the defendant, me and Mr. Malone, had a high risk of reoffending if he did not receive treatment. The trial court sentenced Malone as a Public Act 150 ward and remanded him to the Juvenile Justice Center until placement in a treatment facility. The trial court further ordered that Malone to register under SORA as a Tier 3 offender.
The court noted that under Public Act 150, defendant was placed at a specialized treatment facility and that this placement did not yield positive results. Defendant engaged in grooming behavior with peers. Specifically, he sought out younger individuals or individuals with emotional issues in an attempt to take advantage of them. Defendant did not attempt this behavior with strong peers in his group.
Yes, and that tells me he knew just a tad bit more than what his counsel represented. They also noted that although defendant was on task 3 of his workbook, he was forced to repeat the task because he lied numerous times. At another review hearing, it was learned that defendant was acting out sexually, denied privileges, removed from his peers, and placed in detention. After being given a new supervisor and peer group, defendant improved in his behavior, and these small steps were deemed encouraging. It was determined that defendant would remain in the juvenile program at that point.
All right, well, that's kind of encouraging. So what happened next?
Well, it didn't seem to hold. In February 2017, the trial court was advised that defendant should be resentenced as an adult. Malone had engaged in inappropriate behaviors, including grooming his peers and inappropriate sexual behaviors, made inappropriate comments to staff and peers, and failed to follow the rules. it was concluded that Malone was ineligible for release because he had not incorporated the teachings of the program into his daily life. Despite Malone's lower cognitive ability, it was recommended that he remain in a secure environment because he had a higher probability to reoffend. And after an alternative program for defendant could not be located either in or out of the state of Michigan, he was sentenced as an adult to 36 to 180 months of imprisonment.
Can we go into the court's analysis now?
Let's do it. What do you want to ask me?
All right. Well, they said questions relating to statutory interpretation are reviewed de novo, D-E-N-O-V-O. We'll get to that in a minute. When interpreting a statute, the court's overriding goal is to give effect to the legislature's intent by examining the plainly expressed language. Larry, I got to tell you, there's no plainly expressed language in legal stuff. Also, they said constitutional questions are generally reviewed de novo. What does de novo mean?
What it means is some levels of review are deferential to the trial court. A de novo review is when the trial court doesn't get any level of deference. So these questions about constitutionality, they really don't care what the trial court thought about the constitutionality. There's going to be no deference to the trial court. So it means a brand new review. When you're looking at fact-finding at the trial court, since the appellate court is not finding facts, those findings that were developed in the trial court and in evidence below, those are going to carry over. But a de novo review means that these issues specifically are going to be reviewed with no deferential treatment to the trial judge.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
Malone contended that lifetime SORA registration for juvenile offenders, even when convicted and sentenced as adults, constitutes, on its face, cruel and unusual punishment under Michigan Constitution. Can that standard be met, in your opinion?
No, it cannot, in my opinion. Now, I'm going to set this up by saying Michigan doesn't have a death penalty, and Michigan has its own constitution. But as a general rule, if putting people to death by cruel and barbaric methods, and Alabama's come up with some recent new tactics to put people to death, it's hard to imagine that registration in and of itself can compare to being dead. Maybe it could compare, but I just can't see how if we can torture you for 30, 40 minutes with botched execution, and that's not cruel and unusual. I don't see how we get there with a regulatory scheme.
All right. If Michigan's not one of those states that's trying to come up with whatever concoction they can come up with to nuke people, are they? It's just like the southern states of Mississippi and Alabama, probably Texas or something like that.
Yeah, that's why I qualified it. Michigan hasn't had a death penalty since probably back in the 1870s, so they've long since abolished
it. Oh, seriously? Like that long? Since you were a Ute?
Yeah, I think they abolished it. I remember President Lincoln's push for that. And I think that Michigan was one of the first states that said, yeah, we want to abolish the death penalty. But it's been a long, long time.
Okay. The Michigan legislature enacted SORA in 1994 to better assist law enforcement officers and the people of this state in preventing and protecting against the commission of future criminal sexual acts by convicted PFRs, MCL 28.721A. Although the Enact initially was a confidential database accessible to law enforcement only, it evolved into a computerized database available to the public online. The requirements placed on registrants also expanded to require disclosure of affiliation with an institution of higher learning, an updated photograph, employment status, vehicle information, and shortened registry requirements. I thought that the Michigan Supreme Court had held that registration was not punishment.
They did indeed. And I think I wrote that wrong. I think I meant to say lengthened registry requirements. But that case was the People versus Betts from 2021. The Betts court determined that the 2011 amendments to SORA contained aggregate punitive effects that negated the state's intent to deem it merely a civil regulation. Accordingly, it was concluded that the retroactive application of the 2011 SORA violates Michigan's constitutional ex post facto provisions. And because severability and revival did not provide an adequate remedy, the court held that the 2011 SORA may not be retroactively applied to registrants whose criminal acts subjected them to registration occurred before the enactment of the 2011 amendments.
In light of the determination that the 2011 SOAR amendments constitute punishment, Malone argued that the lifetime registration requirements violate Michigan's Constitution's prohibition on cruel or unusual punishment. Under the Michigan Constitution of 1963, Article 1, Section 16. What is the legal standard for such a challenge?
Well, I'm going to quote directly from the court. When a party asserts a facial challenge to the constitutionality of a statute, the party must demonstrate that no circumstances exist which the statute would be valid. You and the audience have heard me say this dozens, if not hundreds, of times. This is the precise reason why that courts will never declare the act of registration to be facially unconstitutional, because there are circumstances by which you can register people constitutionally.
Using your big Larry brain, could you tell me what Malone would have needed to meet in Michigan to have it be ruled unconstitutional?
I couldn't tell you, but I went and looked that up in the decision, and it says, to determine whether a punishment is cruel or unusual, courts must assess whether it's unjustifiably disproportionate to the offense committed by the considering the following four factors. One, the harshness of the penalty compared to the gravity of the offense. Two, the penalty imposed for the offense compared to the penalties imposed for other offenses in Michigan. Three, the penalty imposed for the offense in Michigan compared to the penalty imposed for the same offense in other states. And four, whether the penalty imposed advances the goal of rehabilitation.
Malone argued that the severity of the offense, rubbing his junk against the 14-month-old butt, was not the most heinous act because the victim will have no memory of the incident. Now, Larry, now that's a funny argument to make, that the 14-month-old won't have a memory of it. Therefore, it's okay to do. Malone further contended that he would be given a social stigma and branded as a PFR, subject to a plethora of registration requirements and unable to petition for removal, without consideration of the science pertaining to the juvenile brain. Now, what was the court's take on that?
Well, they didn't respond very well. They said, contrary to defendant's assertion, defendant initially reported to the police that he penetrated the victim, but later claimed that he merely rubbed externally against the victim. Regardless of this contention, the defendant nonetheless penetrated the victim, and contrary to the defendant's claim, the gravity of the offense was the most heinous. The defendant removed the victim from the care of an adult and took him to another room. Their defendant decided to engage in gross stuff and employed the victim, God, this is still bad, in a sexual act by removing pajamas and diaper to do naughty things. The victim was only 14 months old and was limited in the ability to ascertain what was transpiring as well as to articulate the need for help. And it certainly seems predatory to me.
I'm pretty sure that this guy needs some treatment. Can you see that?
Well, yes, I saw it, and so did the court. He had been in treatment and care of the mental health professionals for a number of years, yet it did not appear that he benefited from medication and treatment. He committed the offense at the age of 16, was sentenced to a juvenile facility at 17, and then resentenced at 19 because treatment wasn't taking hold. At the time of his sentencing as an adult, the defendant was deemed a high risk to reoffend. The court noted that the contention that the severity of the offense does not equate with the harshness of the penalty is not supported by the record. In light of the gravity of the defendant's offense, mandatory lifetime registration is a proportionate punishment. So says the court.
Now, to be fair, Larry, this is for the rest of his life. Is it not possible that he could change?
It is certainly possible that he could change. But unfortunately, the people of Michigan have made the law. Malone also contended that the penalty imposed, mandatory lifetime registration, is exceedingly rare and more severe because the punishment will last longer on a youthful offender as opposed to an adult offender. Now, you have to give him credit. That's a creative argument.
That's a good one. I mean, if you got sentenced, I mean, you're already 180 versus him. He was 16 or whatever. So that's a long time versus you don't have much time left.
So lifetime registration, however, is not the only mandatory penalty imposed under Michigan law. Mandatory lifetime imprisonment is the penalty imposed for first-degree murder. And can you admit that lifetime on the registry is less harsh than lifetime in prison?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. Because sometimes in prison is easier than the registry for certain people. I got it. For some people, it's going to be easier. Malone notes that an examination of other jurisdiction reveals that only 18 states have substantially implemented the federal Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, otherwise known as SORNA, and there is no uniform view that these registries operate to improve public safety, and research indicates that the dangerousness of PFRs has been overblown. He further submitted that individual considerations of the juveniles are more desirable and appropriate. Can you not admit that both of these statements are true?
I can admit that, but that's for the people of Michigan to determine, not for the courts. Remember, no legislating from the bench. Do you not remember that? We want people who wear those robes to interpret the laws that have been made, not to create their own law. And you keep forgetting that Malone, when he did not comply with the rules of the facility, he did not obey the staff, and he engaged in inappropriate sexual behaviors. He was warned of the consequences of his noncompliance. In an attempt to obtain compliance and ensure that Malone incorporated the lessons into his daily life, he was even given a new supervisor and a peer group. What more did you want from them?
So then you just suggest that the guy give up and just say, well, this is my fate?
Well, I don't know that I'd say you give up, but you move on to plan B. And that's what they did. They moved on to plan B. They said treatment is not working, and we have the option to put you into a different system, and that's what they did. But as the court noted, Malone simply could not be released from the program due to his failure to benefit. I mean, that would be the state giving up. Well, we tried treatment, so we'll just let a high-risk offender just turn him loose. So thus, according to the court, regardless of the number of states that have adopted a PFR registries, whether the registries benefit public safety and recidivism of PFRs, generally defendant committed criminal sexual contact in the second degree with a 14-month-old victim. His penalty involved treatment in a juvenile facility. Despite all that care and supervision of staff, he had deliberately attempted to groom vulnerable peers and engage in inappropriate sexual behaviors. Defendant was deemed high risk of reoffending, and his inappropriate conduct, and he continued to engage in inappropriate acts in front of supervising adults. He left them no choice. Can you not admit that?
I think I can. Lastly, Malone argued that that a remand is warranted for an evidentiary hearing to determine whether mandatory lifetime SOAR registration is cruel or unusual punishment as applied to him. What did they say in response to all of that?
Well, they said a statute is not deemed unconstitutional simply because of a hypothetical may cast doubt upon it. Rather, the analysis must focus on whether the statute as applied to the actions of the individual defendant is constitutional. That's what they said.
Malone questions whether he has the ability to comply with the many procedural requirements of SORA in light of his mental capacity and in the absence of assistance. Now, do you think that that's a valid point?
Well, I can see it has some validity, but he didn't preserve that. He didn't raise mental health issues as a defense to the underlying crime. And this means that he is presumed to be mentally stable and healthy, and he didn't preserve that issue in any way for review. And the court noted at this point, this is a hypothetical, and it's insufficient to raise an as-applied challenge or to warrant a remand to the trial court. I mean, his attorney possibly botched it up.
Isn't Michigan one of those states that has the never-ending civil commitment for PFRs?
I don't think they do, actually.
Am I thinking of, what's the state nearby? Is it Illinois?
Illinois does have it, yes.
Okay, well, that's probably worse than lifetime in prison. Because at least in lifetime in prison, you know there's no end. If you're in civil commitment, you sort of think that you may get out at some point in time. You just don't know when. If you have lifetime, you know it's never.
That is true.
So what's next for Malone?
The Michigan Supreme Court is certainly an option.
And would you suggest he do that?
I would not. This is a horrible candidate for such an endeavor. I think there's virtually no chance of a different outcome with the state Supreme Court.
I need you to give me two hypotheticals and use your Larry brain again. What attorney would take this on? Does this guy, is he rolling around in cash to hire an attorney? Is there some brand new law school graduate that decided to take on the impossible case to make a name for themselves? What attorney would take this on?
It could have been either of the above. It could be that their family has lots of money. And it could be that he genuinely believes in what he's doing. He or she, that attorney, may believe wholeheartedly that they're doing the right thing. Because we hate to write off a juvenile offender. I hate to write off a juvenile offender. But in this particular case, I can see how they got to their answer, although it's sad.
Yeah. And I don't think we really hit home the whole concept. I mean, the reason why you brought this up, talking about it in pre-show, was that if this doesn't meet the standard of cruel and unusual, if the whole execution thing, if that's not cruel and unusual punishment, then just dealing with some lifetime registration stuff. Like, we need to hammer home that whole thing about people thinking that this is unconstitutional, this or that.
It's certainly going to be difficult to make the case ever that registration is cruel and unusual punishment. We've successfully reached the conclusion that it can be punitive, but being punishment does not magically translate to being cruel, nor does it translate to being unusual. And that's what people miss out on. I've had intense arguments with people. They say, well, Larry, don't you understand? The court has already held its punishment. I say, I understand that. It's a different standard. Punishment and cruel and unusual punishment are two different standards.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying there. But there have been a mountain of cases that have been one on our side of things saying that this is not what the registry was, adding these things as ex post facto and so forth, that this then starts to look like a punishment scheme instead of it being just a registration scheme.
That is correct. And you can do a punishment scheme prospectively. And that's what happened to this guy. These things were enacted after he committed his heinous series of events. And therefore, it's not punishment is applied to him necessarily. And they decided, even though he argued it's punishment, it's certainly not cruel and unusual punishment. And they found it to be very appropriate punishment.
I see. I don't like these cases, Larry. I don't like talking about them because the whole reason that this whole PFR industrial complex exists is because of a guy like this. And so any of us that have the most, I don't want to diminish it to this point, but this guy is so far on the extreme end of things that anything else, you just get lumped in with this guy.
It's sad, but there are people like that really. This is the person we always dread when we're approaching a legislative session. What happens if someone like this man commits an offense 2 weeks before the legislature kicks off for a session?
Oh, wow. I don't even really think about that being part of something that you have to account for when you're trying to go talk to your legislative bodies.
Well, it would be when you have a high-profile case happen. Then they say, well, Larry, what about this? You know, this is why we have the registry. What do you say in response?
I'd probably just like tuck my tail and go home and say, I'll try again another time.
Correct.
So I had that one right?
Yep.
Okay. Then we shall move along. Hey, we're going to kick you out of the show with some happy news. We'll call this the kicker. And this is from the Los Angeles Times. Wrongly accused of rape in Los Angeles County as a teen, man freed from prison after 28 years. Gerardo God, we talked about this. Cabanillas? Is that what it is? Cabanillas?
Yes.
Okay, wow. Gerardo Cabanillas swore on his child's life that he was innocent when he was arrested on suspicion of sexual assault at the age of 18, his attorney said. Yet, he confessed anyway when a Southgate police detective allegedly promised he'd be given probation as long as he admitted to the crime. Oh my God. That false promise left Cabanillas in prison for nearly 3 decades until DNA evidence showed someone else had committed the crime. Official said. Flanked by his family, attorneys, and Los Angeles County District Attorney George Gascon Cabanillas stood in the downtown Hall of Justice as an innocent man Tuesday, as officials discussed his bittersweet, recently vacated conviction. How did this come about?
It came about, this conviction, I would say, because of poor police work and totally inadequate legal representation. If I've got a client telling me that I did not do this, I'm going to say one thing to the client. First off, I'm going to say, well, we're going to have to look and see what they can convict you of. What evidence do they have? Well, okay. I'm going to look at your confession. I'm going to say, well, you confessed. So they've got some pretty convincing, compelling evidence. Well, but they tortured me. They tricked me. And then when they say, but I didn't do it, I'm going to say, okay, well, here's the next thing I'm going to do. I'm going to hook you up to the Kabuki machine and see what it says. I mean, that's what I'm going to do next. I know it's not the cure-all, end-all, but it usually has resulted in people admitting after they failed the Kabuki machine that they did do it. So the next thing I would do is hook him up to the Kabuki machine with a reputable examiner and see what the results of the test would be. This is all we've got, though. I mean, look, would you rather him plead guilty and get 28 years in prison?
No, but you just used Kabuki machine and reputable, whatever term you, I can't see how those two words go together.
Well, there are people who try to do to follow the science as they understand it, they've been taught, and they frame up the pre-exam interview with with questions that are appropriate, and they try their best to get the result from the machine as best as it can render. But I'm trying to get you to admit that either you did or didn't do it. Yes. Because I can't plead you to something that you insist you didn't do. Certainly. So that's what I would have done to see if he passed the Kabuki machine. Now, if he did fail the Kabuki machine, then we would have a talk. But if he passed it, then I'm going to be on the phone with the prosecutor and saying, hey, I got a problem here.
Yeah. Right.
Your detective extracted a confession from a young person, and that confession is highly suspect to me because ex-polygrapher, and usually you use someone who law enforcement has been in law enforcement and is well respected by the prosecution. And this polygrapher says that my client is being honest, and we have the discussion. But that's what I would have done. And then after that, you have to open up a budget and start doing an investigation, trying to figure out if you can find witnesses that know something or heard something and identify. And all those things cost money when you have to put some boots on the ground to try to figure out what happened. But that would be the course of action that I would follow.
Cabanillas was accused of a brutal robbery at gunpoint and sexual assault of a young woman in Southgate in 1995, officials said. During a 7-hour interrogation during which Cabanillas didn't have access to an attorney, how did that part happen, Larry? Southgate Detective Jack Lee I can't say these names! What is that one?
Ellery's.
Detective Jack Lee Ellery's promised the young man he would be released on probation if he admitted to what he was being accused of. Instead, Cabanillas was charged with how many? 14 felonies, convicted and sentenced to de facto life sentence, court records show. Good grief.
And Cabanillas denied all wrongdoing for decades, and his case was finally taken up by the California Innocence Project in 2017. This year, DNA evidence not only cleared Cabanillas, but also identified another suspect who is already in prison awaiting trial for murder. Now, isn't that funny?
That would be the same person who then they think did this one? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they identified with a DNA hit a person who's already in prison, in custody, awaiting trial for murder. So it sounds like not a very nice person, but he got away with it for 30 years, practically.
But he's already in prison.
Yes, but he got away with this crime for 30 years. So,
yeah, we don't know how long that guy's been locked up. Good grief. Oh, my God. What is your opinion of the bazillions of DNA kits sitting in police lockers?
Well, I don't really have an opinion other than that they should be analyzed, and I think they're making great strides in clearing the backlog, but it costs money, you know?
I do, but then the way that I hear it is that DAs are, they do stonewall to some degree about having them analyzed and worked with.
I don't know that that's the case. I have not really experienced that particular aspect.
Okay. I will have to get more information on that and then take you to the Met, and we'll have a showdown on that subject. Larry, I want to get out of here. I'm tired. I had a long day.
All right, let's do it.
All right. Well, so if you want to go over to registrymatters.co, you can find the show notes and you can download the podcast there. You can subscribe to it there. You can find links to Patreon, which is patreon.com/registrymatters. Please come in and join the program. Support the show. If you come in at like the, I think it's the $15 level, you could use that as a mechanism to send the transcript off to someone that is locked up. If you want to do that, that's a very nice way to donate and get the transcript sent to somebody. And I think that's all I got, Larry. We record this usually at 7 o'clock on Saturday nights, and then Larry sometimes pulls a fast one on me, says we're not going to record, but then here we are. That's all I got.
Well, we'll see you on the next episode.
Take care, Larry. I'll talk to you soon. Have a great night and see everybody later. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.